Yesterday I was, I've been thinning trees over across the road on our property, and I went out, I've been going out in the morning pretty early, and I was riding out there on the tractor yesterday morning, and when I came down to where I was, to my kind of lower area where I've been stacking trees, there was three bull elk standing there in the road. And as I drove up towards them, they went off into the woods. And so I thought, boy, that's neat. I've never seen, only seen one elk here before. And this is the time of year when I think the young bulls get congregate together. I think they get kicked out of the herd so the ladies can have their young in peace, probably. Anyway, I went up the hill. I started working. And after about an hour and a half, I thought, that was so neat to see that bunch of elk, you know. I turned around and there was four of them just standing there looking at me. And just a, you know, short stone throw away, maybe 40 yards, maybe 35, 40 yards, just looking at me. So I walked towards them. I started talking to them. I said, you guys got to be more afraid of people. You know, someone's going to shoot you. And they're completely unimpressed, and they just stood there. I kept walking towards them talking, and they just stood there. One of them just put his head down and munched something. They're totally unimpressed. And so then I went back and got on the tractor and ran at them. Figured, well, because you know the old story about the Zen master beating the deer with a stick to make him afraid of people? You don't do that with an elk, a bull elk. So I thought, in the spirit of the thing, I would run at them with a tractor, and they just kind of walked off into the woods. And later on, I looked back, and there was another one, and then another one. So I spent the morning yesterday with the elk. I went back yesterday afternoon walking the dogs, and they were still there up at the top of that hill. And then, so here's why I'm telling this story, apart from the fact it's a neat story. But so Rim Master Mugo and I went over this morning. I was going to work, and we were going to see if we'd see the elk again. No sign of whatsoever. The camera, you know. And I thought later, well, you know, that's just like enlightenment, you know. Enlightenment catches you by surprise when you're least expecting it. When you go looking for it, you can't find it anywhere. You can't find any sign of it whatsoever. Rim Master used to talk about, you can take your hand, you can trail it in the river, and the water flows, and your hand is one with the river there. You grab at it, and you come up, and there's nothing in your hand. You grab it, you got nothing. And enlightenment is just like that. Enlightenment's like the brotherhood of elk over there. You go looking for it, you can't find it. It's nowhere to be seen. It seems non-existent. When you're not looking for it and you least expect it and you're just living and just working, just living from your heart, just doing your training, then enlightenment catches you. D.T. Suzuki, I remember, used to quote what he said. He said, once or twice I've had the great experience, but 1,000 times I've had the little moments that make you dance. And when you ever have the little moment that makes you dance, where there's that upwelling of joy and gratitude in the heart, that's a little moment of enlightenment. And enlightenment can't be cut into, another thing Rim Master used to say, you can't cut it into pieces. It's whole and of one piece. See, in the least little moment of enlightenment is the whole of enlightenment revealing itself. And as soon as you grasp after a moment of it, any aspect of it, it's completely vanished and nowhere to be found. This is why it eludes the people who have pride of intellect and who try to approach it through intellect. Rim Master said that there's, in Buddhism, there's three main paths in Buddhism. One of them is the path of meditation that we follow. Another one is the path of devotion, which is a the Buddha, the Zen, in Mahayana Buddhism, the Zen schools of which Soto Zen is the oldest and is the one that's truest to the old ways. Anyway, the Zen schools emphasize meditation. The Shin school in Mahayana Buddhism emphasizes devotion. And then you have the kind of way of the intellect, the third way, kind of scholarly and intellectual approach to Buddhism. And she said of the three, that's the slowest. The slowest. The head root is the slowest. Trying to understand it rather than just taking a simple, straightforward approach of faith and just doing the training and trusting that one day enlightenment will just catch you when you least expect it. Then if it catches you, and then you start looking over your shoulder and go hunting for the Brotherhood of Elk the next day, you see no sign of it whatsoever. So what is it that it's doing? What is it that enlightenment is doing there? By being that way. Enlightenment is teaching us or training us in not having expectations. Living without an expectation and without not only expectation, but without an insistence or a demand. Because wherever we have an expectation or insistence or a demand, whatever it's for, enlightenment won't show itself there, in that area. And if it's for enlightenment itself, least of all will it show itself. So in both the schools that emphasize meditation and the schools that emphasize devotion, you need very strong faith. I suppose you could say that since the scholarly approach and the intellectual approach is the slowest of all, you need the most faith of all. But then if you had more faith, you wouldn't do that one. You'd just do the others. One of the others. Now, of the meditation and the devotional schools or branches of Mahayana Buddhism, in the long run, they amount to the same thing. It's like, as Ramesh used to say, it's like a tunnel that has two entrances, Well, if you go in the meditation end, then your exit end is the devotion end. If you go in the devotion end, your exit end is the meditation end. But in either case, you'll end up in the same place. And then within any particular school of Buddhism, you find all three actually present to some degree or other. It's true in Soto Zen, certainly. Soto Zen in Japan has as of maybe 20, 30 years ago, and probably the finest Buddhist studies program in its university in the world, probably. And that doesn't stand against meditation and devotion so long as the meditation or devotion comes first. But if the intellectual side of things comes first, then that really slows you down. It's a funny thing about that elusiveness of enlightenment. it's kind of like the elusiveness of the atmosphere. You know, you can't see it. I just saw a thing on the NASA channel yesterday evening. I love the NASA channel. You know, the kind of space program propaganda channel, but it's got some really neat things, and it has some kids, educational shows for kids, you know, and they're really kind of corny, like 50s kind of. I can't imagine any real kids believing that those kids are like real kids, it's like so obviously written by adults for kids, and some adult who doesn't know kids. But that's okay, because the information they give is really neat. And they were talking about the atmosphere on the thing I was watching last night, and how, you know, you can't see it, but it's made up of all these gases and everything. And well, enlightenment is like that. Enlightenment is like that. You know, you're breathing it all the time, spiritually, you're breathing enlightenment all the time. It sustains your life all the time. It is your life, really, enlightenment. And yet you can't directly sense it. You can't directly sense it. So, you know, another thing that elusiveness of it is teaching us is of the necessity of faith. That since you can't get at it directly with the senses, and you can't get at it directly with the intellect, what do you get at it with? Where is it within yourself? Where is it within your total body and mind that you sense enlightenment? It's in intuition. It's in pure spiritual intuition. And what is the essence of faith? It is pure spiritual intuition. Unalloyed, pure intuition, unalloyed by thought or perception or anything. So, like, how can you even have any experience of it if it's so unalloyed with anything else? Even though it's unalloyed with it, it can manifest through every other aspect of your being. And in fact, it does so constantly. But again, if you use some other aspect of your being to try to get at it, there's nothing there. This is made a lot more difficult for people. Another thing Ramesh used to say that really is true, that we brainwash our young at a very early age. In fact, it's at an earlier and earlier age in our culture. We brainwash people, and they're very, very young, to basically ignore their intuition and listen just to their heads. We train people in the intellect, the use of the intellect, very, very early now, you know, before kindergarten now. For many people, kind of competitive pushing of little kids. You know, learn to read earlier and earlier. You know, learn to do arithmetic and stuff earlier and earlier. All the emphasis on the brain. But because the parents themselves are so often ignorant of the role of spiritual intuition in their own lives, they're ignorant of it, of the role in their children's life. But in fact, children are much closer to it than most adults. As are animals, for that matter. But that intuition I'm speaking of, which is the very essence of faith, is where faith originates from. You don't, like, kind of have to trump up faith or kind of muster up faith. All you have to do is be still, and faith is there. Why is that? Because it always was there. Its reality is rooted in Buddha nature itself and enlightenment itself. And it's not going anywhere. In the kind of more, you could say esoteric, but esoteric is not really the right word. You could say the deeper teachings of Soto Zen. It's called the residual Buddha nature. And it's called residual Buddha nature because to try to indicate that no matter what happens, it's always there. No matter how obscured the Buddha nature itself becomes, seemingly, by greed, hate, and delusion, by confusion and pain, underneath it, within it, there is this spark of reality, a spark of truth that is inextinguishable in any being, no matter what anyone does. And it can always be accessed if one will just be still within one's heart and look up. In other words, not willfully give in to despair. And yet when you go deliberately looking for it, it's gone. But when you just allow your mind and heart to be still and look up, spiritually look up, then with your peripheral vision, as it were, there it is, over there, like the brotherhood of elk. It was really neat. I'm sitting there, I was, you know, down there unchaining a log. I just dragged. I think that's what I was doing. And I had this thought, that was so neat to see those elk. And the next instant, there they were. You know, I just turned my head. There they were. Only four of them this time. And that spark of enlightenment is like that. It's just like that. And there's one more thing. The appreciative heart sees it more often, catches that glimpse of it more often. The grateful and appreciative mind and heart catches that glimpse of it, that peripheral glimpse, more often. I'm not going to carry that analogy too far, because I don't know what it is. You get on the tractor and run at them, you know. Storming heaven, I guess. But as far as it goes, it's a good analogy. So this is a peculiar retreat because most people, this is the first time it's ever happened, because most of the people here have come from out of state, and some of you a very long ways for a very short time, really. If you ask me, you're a bit daft, but, you know, it's your business, not mine. But don't waste your time coming here looking for enlightenment. Just do a weekend's meditation. And allow room for the heart to do its own thing. When we least expect it, there it is, it shows up, just looking at us. And when most think it ought to be there, by God, it ought to be there. Why isn't it there? The more we do that, the less it's there. That's why there's so much despair in modern kind of secular material society. Because it's so linked to pride of intellect, actually. We can solve all these other problems, although we create more problems as we solve them. I don't know if anyone ever notices that. Why can't, you know, where's God? What happened to God? Why is God so elusive? Why doesn't God show himself or herself or itself? Of course, the real answer is, where is there not God? Why do we make ourselves so willfully oblivious to what is so obvious? remember that? Anyone ever remember that movie Looking for Mr. Goodbar with Diane Keaton? God awful, despairing, realistic, but bummer, major bummer. But it's I remember the movie ad, you know, the kind of poster for the movie. It said, "Looking for love in all the wrong places," and that's what we do. It's hard for to see it when we're looking in the wrong places or with the wrong attitude of mind. But when we stop looking for it and just be still and just live from our heart, then there it is, continually surprising us, over and over again surprising us. It's an amazing thing that just living, doing what needs to be done, and having a life that rotates around meditation, accomplishes what no amount of desperate striving and kind of cultivation, self-improvement, and education or anything else can do. It accomplishes what nothing else can do. The real meaning of that verse in the Bible, the meek shall inherit the earth. I hope you have a good weekend. Just do the things that need to be done without looking for anything whatsoever. And what you're not looking for will be right there looking at you. The Brotherhood of Elks.